These lectures are part of the Great Courses series. They are produced by the Teaching Company. These lectures are titled, The Long Shadow of the Ancient Greek World, Part 3. Lecture 25, Democracy and Political Speech, Then and Now.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back. In this lecture, we're going to examine the differences between the classical Athenian democracy and that of our own. I want to focus on the shortcomings of the Athenian system and consider how accurate its label of democracy really was. Then I want to turn to the difference between ancient and modern rhetoric and look at how the classical speeches have influenced those that have been delivered in more recent times. So let's begin with ancient and modern democracy. The Greek word demokratia gives us our word democracy, and it literally means the people. That's the demos. And demos here is in a technical sense. It's not used in the sense of town as we've met before, as in the Cleisthenic demes. Demokratia then means the people possess the political power, that's the kratos, in the state. Put demos and kratos together, demokratia. The people possess the political power in the state. Now, the people meant the entire citizen body, as it does today. But in Athens, citizenship was decided by birth. Women and foreigners could not vote. And even in those polis that were democratic, slavery was widespread. There are immediate similarities and differences between then and now. Although in a country like America, foreigners cannot vote and cannot hold office, women certainly have the right to vote and take part in government. And you can get citizenship by a variety of means, including permanent residency or the green card status. Once you've been on that green card for a few years and not been naughty in any way, not had any run-ins with the law, for example, then you can apply for citizenship. In Athens, though, Pericles' citizenship law of 451 stipulated that both parents had to be Athenian citizens before children were considered legitimate. Before 451, only one parent had to be Athenian. But Pericles tightened this up. Presumably, he was trying to preserve the exclusivity of Athenian citizenship. And getting citizenship in Athens was as rare as hen's teeth. It took a vote of the assembly to bestow citizenship on someone. And usually, this was on a person who had performed a major service for the city. It could be, for example, a mercenary general who had won great victories for the Athenians, or someone who had given gifts of corn to the city in times of famine. In the Hellenistic period, grants of citizenship become a little more frequent, but again, it's a back-scratching deal. A Hellenistic king who builds a stoa, that's the equivalent of an ancient strip mall, in Athens, and in return, that Hellenistic king gets citizenship. The Athenians did have a group of permanent residents called metics. This word comes from the Greek metoikos, meaning those who live with us, or those who live amongst us. It's very similar to the Spartan perioikoi, those who live around us. But the metics were never eligible for citizenship. Although they were expected to fight for Athens, they were a vital part of the Athenian economy, and they did pay taxes. In fact, they paid a special metic tax for the privilege of living and working in Athens. Another difference between then and now is that in classical Athens, all male citizens, whatever the socio-economic background, whether they were noble or non-noble, had in theory equality in deliberating about state policy and equality in the eyes of the law. The Athenians coined a buzzword for this, isonomia, and they lived by it. In the mid-5th century, Herodotus could say that, quote, the sovereignty of the people has firstly the fairest name of all, equality before the laws. And in the late 4th century, the orator Isocrates says much the same thing. He says, it would be most frightful if, in a democratic city, all men should not have equal rights. Such equality, especially before the law, is supposed to be true today. But there have been enough high-profile cases in recent years to suggest that money and celebrity status don't necessarily work against you. There is, however, a big difference when it comes to exercising political power. In the radical Athenian democracy, that's the one after Ephialtes, there was not really a dividing line between the ordinary citizens and those who were elected to office, unlike today. In the radical democracy, the ordinary people played a far more direct role in political life because it was the assembly that decided all matters of domestic and foreign policy. The assembly was ably backed by the boule, which had all sorts of administrative and judicial functions. And these included hearing major public cases such as eisangeliae or impeachments. The boule also kept an eye on all public officials, it received foreign envoys, and it was responsible for all financial matters, including payments on behalf of the state. There was no opposition party in residence in classical Athens, like today, because there was no need of one. The people were sovereign, and they had the power to impeach or condemn their elected officials. Today, the job of the citizens is to elect its officials, whether these officials are the local mayor, the sheriff, the state governor, or the president or prime minister of the country. Then the people's job is over. It's this elected elite that makes policy. The ordinary people have delegated this job to the elite, and for the most part, they have to go along with what the elite decides. Grumbling and writing blogs are about all we can do if we disagree with things. I mean, despite the extremely low votes of confidence that leaders pull at times, are they ever kicked out? Well, in Australia, in November 1975, the Governor General, that's the Queen's representative, did fire the then Labour Prime Minister, Gough Whitlam, and he appointed the leader of the opposition, Malcolm Fraser, as caretaker Prime Minister. That sparked a constitutional crisis. There was a lovely line that Gough Whitlam delivered about the Governor-General. His name was Sir John Kerr. He said, Kerr might well sing God Save the Queen, but no one's going to save him now. But this sort of thing, firing prime ministers, isn't exactly an everyday occurrence. Thanks to state pay in classical Athens, and state pay was introduced in the 5th century, Athenians could afford to take part in political life, especially serving for that 1 year in Athens on the boule. As we said in our lectures on Cleisthenes, the boule is the closest thing we get to proportional representation in Greece. And once state pay is introduced, that means more people from different areas of Attica could afford to move to Athens for 1 year and be members of the boule. Moreover, since members could be elected to the boule twice, though they couldn't serve in consecutive years, that meant that a fair percentage of those living in rural Attica did take part in the state government at Athens. State pay for attending an assembly, which, by the way, was introduced later at the end of the Peloponnesian War, or state pay for serving as a juror, and this was introduced by Pericles in the 450s, this state pay was not a fortune. It may have amounted to the equivalent of buying a McDonald's Happy Meal today. But it was probably enough to encourage a small farmer or a potter, a small artisan, to take a day off work to attend an assembly, especially if that assembly was debating a major issue, new taxes, going to war, a treaty with another place, for example. And this encouragement to attend the assembly was even more so if our farmer or artisan had a slave or two to carry on the work back home in his master's absence. Now, Greece was a slave-based economy, and oddly to us, slavery afforded the citizens the leisure time to take part in political life. And this is something that I'll go into more detail over in a future lecture. But to us, it sounds very odd that a democracy could condone slavery, and yet slavery was fundamental to its workings. But in Athens and in other democratic polis, that was the case. And here's another difference now between now and then. I'm sure our elected elite today make more than the cost of a Happy Meal. By the way, state pay helps us to see that the majority of polis were not oligarchic, but democratic. Pay for political participation is incompatible with an oligarchic form of government. And Aristotle in the Politics indicates that this type of pay was on a large scale and common to a number of polis. That's why we can say that the nature of the Greek states in the classical period was democratic. Very often you come across in books that the majority of states were oligarchic, that democracy was in a minority. That doesn't seem to be the case. So the Athenian government, I think, set a trend for other polis, because the Athenians invented democracy. Other polis followed suit. And that gives even more legitimacy to the claim of Pericles that Athens was the school of Greece. Now, Pericles makes this claim at the beginning of his funeral oration that was delivered at the end of the first year of the Peloponnesian War, so in 430. He says that Athens was the school of Hellas. Now, he's not just saying that Athens was the place that all other states wanted to be like. He is indicating, I think, that the Athenian system of government, that the Athenian way of life was emulated by other places. And democracy and state pay are two examples of that. Now, all of these differences may seem obvious, differences between now and then. But perhaps less obvious is how we take for granted that people in the Athenian democracy really did have an equal say in state affairs. I mean, this radical system seems to allow that. All male citizens over the age of 18 can go to an assembly, they can debate all matters of domestic and foreign policy, they can vote on them, and however way they vote, that's the final decision. And that sounds wonderful. And Demosthenes, who we've mentioned before, in a speech that was delivered in 355 BC, and although it's later, we can apply it to the 5th century as well, said that Athenian democracy was compassionate towards the weak, that Athenian democracy prohibited powerful individuals acting violently towards others, and that Athenian democracy refused to allow corrupt speakers to influence the masses. Now, this sounds fantastic. In theory, it sounds great. But the reality was very different, thanks to the demagogues. We talked about the rise of the demagogues in the last lecture. And here, I'm not bothered with whether some acted in the best interests of the state or whether others pursued their own agendas. We'll talk about these aspects as we move through the Peloponnesian War and the 4th century. Cleon, for example, as I said last time, is slaughtered by our sources, and yet I think he actually does a good job as a leader. So we'll be looking at the policies of the demagogues as we go along, when we actually get to those historical periods. The point I want to make here in our lecture is the implication of how the demagogues exploited rhetoric to sway the people in an assembly. The implication, that is, for our view of Athenian democracy, one in which all citizens are theoretically equal and that this democracy is compassionate to the poor and the weak and tries to ensure their safety. The assembly might make all the decisions, as we've been saying, and in this respect, the people were sovereign in the state. But if the people as a whole were led by a handful of skillful speakers, then where did real power lie? Did it really lie with the people who actually voted on policy? Or did it lie with the speakers who influenced the people to vote a certain way? Well, the latter seems to be the case, as Thucydides' very telling statement about the power of Pericles shows. Thucydides says that while Athens was in name a democracy, power was in the hands of one man who led the people. While Athens was nominally a democracy, power was in the hands of one man. Wow, that speaks volumes. Classical Athenian democracy was nothing more than a facade then in reality. It was an oligarchy because power lay in the hands of the demagogues. These were always in a minority, swaying the majority of the citizens in an assembly. Incidentally, one thing that we cannot properly work out, by the way, is how politicians marshaled their support in Athens. We know how this happens today, but we don't know how the Athenians who invented democracy did it. A lot seemed to depend on word of mouth and actually knowing the people. Themistocles, for example, was supposed to know the name of every citizen. And we have references to people's friends, in inverted commas, who went around to other people. And that, to me, sounds a lot like modern canvassers. One way of gaining popularity in the state was to perform a liturgy. This was a public service. Now, this was something that only the richest men could afford, because liturgies cost a fortune. For example, a common liturgy was to finance a trireme for a year. Another one was to cover the cost of a chorus at the dramatic festivals. This sort of thing would get your name known. It would be like having a building dedicated to you today that you have funded. But obviously, those without the necessary wealth couldn't do this. Again, then, we see the role that rhetoric and oratorical prowess played for anyone wanting to aspire to political life, given the absence of the organized political support and the parties that we're used to today. Now, these leaders, these rhetores, were not elected to any office, as we've said before. What that meant, of course, was they couldn't technically be impeached or censured in some other way, as was the case with elected officials. And the Athenians were very quick to censure their elected officials if they messed up. They couldn't do this with the rhetores. Also, the rhetores were able to work on the emotions of the people and get them to vote their way. Sometimes good, sometimes bad. As we'll see, the assembly made disastrous decisions during the Peloponnesian War because it was inexpert. And it cost Athens the war, I think. At least, that's the argument I'll be putting towards you when we get to the war. A democracy cannot run a war. And we all know how we react in an emotionally charged atmosphere. And that's what the assembly was. Imagine thousands of people gathered together on top of this rock, being whipped up to jeer, to cheer, to shout, to vote. You would end up doing things that by yourself or just amongst a small group of people, you would not ordinarily do. It's an emotionally charged atmosphere. Perhaps we need to be more careful when we talk about the roots of our democracy lying in that of the Athenian. And perhaps we need to be thankful that at least the line today between leaders and the led is clearly marked. We've seen that rhetoric developed alongside democracy. Or is it the other way around? Perhaps this is too much like the chicken and the egg question. But if our own political system, indeed society, owes so much to ancient democracy, what is the debt to ancient rhetoric, given how inextricably rhetoric and democracy are linked? Now, one obvious difference between rhetoric then and now is that in the classical period, there was an emphasis on performance. It's how you put yourself over. Now, the emphasis is on understanding and interpretation. In other words, it's not so much the content of the speech that persuades the people in classical Greece, but the performance of the speaker. But today, we can dissect the content of speeches. We can think about what people say, because we have experts to analyze these speeches for us and give us reports about them on talking head shows and things like that. And moreover, we have the time to do this. Remember, the Athenian assembly met for one day, dawn to dusk. In that time, the people heard a number of speeches on a variety of proposals for the first time. And then the people had to vote yes or no. Rushed, yes. Expert, no. At the same time, we're still aware today of rhetorical tricks, verbal and otherwise. Can politicians today, for example, truthfully say they know how hard it is to make ends meet when many of them are multimillionaires? Do politicians really want to kiss those horrible-looking babies? But we accept these sorts of things. We know they're part of the performance, and we even condone them then. That's why, for me anyway, it's refreshing when a politician speaks bluntly, rather than spouts out that sort of underwhelming diplomatic speak that we hear all the time. But perhaps the use of rhetoric today is another reason why those in the public eye, especially politicians, get compared to the great orators of the past, in particular Demosthenes. Because Demosthenes is regarded as ancient Greece's greatest orator, by the ancients as well as by modern scholars, I'm going to mention him a few times, even though we won't meet him in his own historical period until the later part of our course. It's fascinating, though, how he is invoked and evoked today. For example, in 2008, a former editor of the Times newspaper in the United Kingdom, William Rees-Mogg, called Senator Barack Obama the most inspirational presidential candidate since John F. Kennedy, and even a better speaker than Kennedy. Right, we might expect that type of comparison. But then in a Financial Times blog of the same year, Obama was compared to Demosthenes. Also in the United Kingdom, as John Prescott retired from being deputy leader of the Labour Party, another politician called him a cross between Ernie Bevin and Demosthenes. Mr. Bevin was a poorly educated man, but because of his trade union work and industrial relations, became a cabinet minister in the post-war governments of Winston Churchill and Clement Attlee. Perhaps another debt that modern rhetoric has to ancient, or rather modern orators have to the classical, is the understanding that even someone who might be a natural speaker must practice. Demosthenes fought a major speech impediment and then worked even harder to perfect his speaking techniques so he could rise to political power. When he was once asked what was necessary to give an effective speech, he said three things: rehearsal, rehearsal, rehearsal. He apparently never gave impromptu speeches, even when he was beseeched to do so in the assembly. We can see the parallels of politicians in more recent times who learn from the likes of Demosthenes that where there's a will, there's a way. But it takes years of hard slog and hundreds of speeches to get there. For example, it took years for Winston Churchill to overcome a lisp and a stammer. But you'd never know that when you hear his "We will fight them on the beaches" speech. And how many people know that in public speaking, there was a certain person at Crozer Seminary who got a C+, and his name was Martin Luther King Jr. Classical rhetoric has also been a great model for speech writers. Two speeches that come to mind here that I think show the modern debt to the classical are President Lincoln's Gettysburg Address of 1863 and President Bill Clinton's speech at the United States National Cemetery above Omaha Beach on June 6, 1994, and this marked the 50th anniversary of the D-Day landing. Both of these have as their model Pericles' great funeral oration, which he delivered at the end of the first year of the Peloponnesian War. Now, the funeral oration, or in Greek, the word epitaphios, which gives us our word epitaph, the funeral oration was a very solemn speech in which the speaker acknowledged the ultimate sacrifice of those who had fallen. It praised their nobility because they died for a great ideal, for freedom, for their city, for its democratic constitution. And it also goes on to say that they have won eternal renown for their selfless deeds. By justifying their deaths in this way, the speaker attempts to lift the hearts and spirits of his audience, many of whom suffered losses. So in many respects, a funeral oration is more for the living than the dead. In Pericles' speech, the constant themes include the memory and glory of the dead, which will be ageless. It will never fade. Another theme is that the city will never stop honoring them. They have won eternal renown. That our way of life is worth fighting for, even if we have to die for it. And as I said, Pericles even calls Athens and its democracy the school of Greece. Now, funeral orations that we have by other orators throughout the classical period echo the same sentiments. These sentiments are echoed in Lincoln's Gettysburg Address with such things as, "The world will little note, nor long remember what we say here, but it can never forget what they did here. It is for us, the living, rather, to be dedicated here to the unfinished work which they who fought here have thus far so nobly advanced." And in President Clinton's speech, we have, "On this field, there are 9,386 who did not return home. They were the fathers we never knew, the uncles we never met, the friends who never returned, the heroes we can never repay. They gave us our world. And those simple sounds of freedom we hear today are their voices speaking to us across the years. 50 years ago, the first Allied soldiers to land here in Normandy came not from the sea, but from the sky. They were called pathfinders, the first paratroopers to make the jump. Deep in the darkness, they descended upon these fields to light beacons for the airborne assaults that would soon follow. Now, near the dawn of a new century, the job of lighting these beacons falls to our hands. To you who brought us here, I promise we will be the new pathfinders, for we are the children of your sacrifice." John F. Kennedy's first speechwriter, Ted Sorensen, told him to use Lincoln's Gettysburg Address as a model. As we can see, Sorensen was telling him ultimately to use Pericles' speech as his model. I'm sure you can come up with other examples if you can put your mind to it. Our democracy might be different from what it was in the classical period, but apart from the different circumstances, the dependence on rhetoric has changed so little. We've needed to chart the rise of the demagogues so that we can understand as best we can why the Athenians did what they did in their history after 462, how politics were practiced in classical times, and the differences between the political systems of classical Athens and now. And talking of now, we turn to the Peloponnesian War to see how that war is a glaring example not only of the civil strife and destruction that can be caused by states operating for their own imperialistic best interests, but also of the very real downsides to direct democracy. With these sobering thoughts in mind, let's go to war. Thank you very much.